start with this this question. Have you lost the glory of God? Have you or I, us as a fellowship, us as a nation, us as a world, have we simply lost the glory of God? Have we just forgotten it? Have we forgotten the glory of God? Maybe that's the issue. Maybe it's there and we've just forgotten it. Maybe it's there and we just can't see it. Or simply, have we ever known it? Are we, if we were to talk about the glory of God, would it just, I don't even know what you're talking about. Never seen it, never experienced it. I wonder what you make of the glory of God. Maybe you've never considered it before. In the previous weeks, I apologise, it's kind of been over a number of different weeks, so we've lost some kind of continuity. But we've been really looking at a decline of a nation. The glory of God in the nation appears to have dwindled. We've looked over the prophet and the priest and the king. We've been looking at how a prophecy in the nation has kind of disappeared. Basically, God speaking to the nation. No one has heard from God for a long time. The priesthood, those people who were meant to stand between man and God, they're corrupt. So the method that is meant to be there to understand and see the glory of God is broken. And then time and time again, when you go through the book of Judges, it simply talks about there is no king in Israel, there is no king in Israel, nobody's in charge. How's anybody meant to find the glory of God in such a situation? God's people are hitting rock bottom. They're up against their neighbours, their rivals. The Philistines keep attacking. They need to be delivered. They need to be saved. The time of the judges, where God has been bringing particular people to look after the nation, is going. People tend to look at the judges as there being 12, if you kind of ignore Samuel and Eli. And some people even like to think that perhaps there was one judge for each tribe in Israel. But certainly they were spread across Israel, as if a judge has appeared from every area in Israel, has helped them out, saved them from their enemies, but the luck is running out. Things are going wrong. And it's all because they've forgotten their God. Politically, religiously, the system is crumbling. And we leave the story last time where God has been almost exiled out of Israel. The Ark of the Covenant has been captured by the Philistines. And we saw this great story of the Ark of the Covenant going out into the Philistine nations, and they just don't know what to do with it. They suffer greatly because of it, and then the Ark of the Covenant comes back in to the land, and that's where we are at the moment. The Ark of the Covenant is back in the land with Israel. The symbol of the presence of God is the Ark of the Covenant. But when we went through that passage, we didn't really stop to pick up on some of the details. One thing that I just want you to note is when you look at chapters 4 and to chapter 7, it has a sandwich structure. Much of this is quite poetic, quite beautiful in the way in which the words of the Bible have been put together, and even the structures and what the writers want us to see. If you were to look at chapter 4, verse 1, you look at the Philistines. They were attacking. You come to the end in chapter 7, the Philistines attacking. That's kind of like your bread and your sandwich. There is war. After the first attack, they lose the ark. And then before the final attack, the ark comes back. So in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside where? Ebenezer." That's the place of their defeat to the Philistines, first of all, when they lose the ark. Then in chapter 7, verse 12, when they have defeated the Philistines in the second battle, it says, then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen. So not at Ebenezer, between Mizpah and Shen. And they called it Ebenezer, saying, thus far the Lord has helped us. So you get Ebenezer at the front, Ebenezer at the end. Defeat and victory. Then you come inside the sandwich. The ark goes and the ark comes back. But the whole structure of this sandwich is there meant to point us to a very curious section in the middle. And that section in the middle is quite intriguing. It's the thing that we should be focusing on. And this is what it says in the section in the middle. It's all to do with Eli, the judge at the time, and his death. The guy who was meant to be in charge and didn't do a very good job. It said, Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy. He was fat. Interesting point. The Bible is quite interesting in its little details and the things that it wants us to know. You know, why know that he's fat? It's actually incredibly important. The thing that we meant to see about this central passage is, why does it talk about this? It's because it's talking about the glory of God. And we'll just show why. Because in that passage, as Eli dies, it talks about his daughter-in-law, and she gives birth. And she gives birth to a boy, and his name is Ichabod. And she calls him Ichabod because it says in verse 21 of chapter 4, it says, then she named the child Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God has been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her brother and her husband. Right in the middle, the thing that is at stake is the glory of God. Okay, there's a war. Okay, the ark is gone and come back. But the point is whether or not the Israelites have the glory of God or not with them. And for us, it's exactly the same. Do we have the glory of God with us? It's the central focus of this whole section. And the good thing is now we're coming to the section that pulls us out, and hopefully we're going to be led to a better place. This is, in the ups and downs of Israelites' history, this is the trough, this is the rock bottom, the glory of Israel has departed, and hopefully we're going to now raise ourselves out of this hole. Simply, the glory of God simply means weight, the weight of God. When we talk about it, it's to do with how big we perceive him to be. He is massive. We cannot underestimate God. Think of the biggest thing that you can ever think of. And he's bigger because he created it all. How on earth can we lose something so massive is the question. Well, in this passage, in this central part, when we look at Eli, we can lose it because the thing that isn't getting fat isn't because the Israelites have been glorifying God and making God look bigger. Eli has been just making himself fat. How has he been making himself fat? Well, we learn, not just through eating chocolate bars, but because, in particular, he has been eating sacrifices from the altar that were not his. The Bible has some very particular instructions about the sacrifices, and the biggest thing to note was that the fat of the sacrifice was the Lord's. Because that resembled how big the animal was. How much of a sacrifice someone was making when they came with a big, fat, juicy bull. And literally, the joke is in the Bible of what it's pulling out here, and Eli was fat. And that's why he fell over backward. Saying it's because he glorified himself and his sons more than he glorified God. Do you know what? We can do the same thing. God is massive. Even in our songs, you know, when we sing these songs, they're so well written. The weight of the words is so massive that sometimes I just think, I can't even begin to mean the things as I'm saying them because I can't process them quick enough. When we were children, as youth, we would sing a song that you may well be familiar with, Refine as Fire. And it simply says, in the middle of it, I choose to be holy. And when we were on camp, we were given a choice of what song, and one teenager said, I really want to sing this song. And interestingly, a pastor picked us up on it, said, well, why do you want to pick that song? It says, I choose to be holy. Now, there's nothing wrong with singing the song, but the minister at the time just felt, I get the hunch, you want to sing this song because you kind of like the tune, yeah? Do you know what you're saying? And he pulled us up on it and he said, do you know what you're even asking? What would happen if God were to make you holy right now? What would happen? If that request that you just made happened instantaneously, could you even bear it? Become like Jesus Christ himself, follow in his footsteps, be so set apart, so different, so glorious, that humanity would just instantaneously reject you just simply because you're foreign. You've no idea what it is, and we don't like it. And he pulled us up and said, do you really mean that? Do we take the glory of God simply, as massive as it truly is? Another song you may think of, just on a different vein, a Matt Redman song, which is Lord, Let Your Glory Fall. I find this one quite interesting. I quite like the song. And it says, Lord, let your glory fall as on the ancient day. And the thing about this song is that it talks about the fire falling from heaven and landing on the altar of the Lord. And it just bursting up in flame. And then all the people around suddenly start singing. And what is it they start singing? Just remind myself. He is good, his love endures forever. He is good, his love endures forever. The trouble is when I sing that song, I always imagine a different part of the Bible. I imagine another part of the Bible when the glory of God fell, and I'm thinking of Elijah and the fire falling from heaven and the prophets of Baal losing their great argument against God and them being slaughtered. See, the glory of God, the weight of God is like a massive weight, and it's going to fall, and it can fall one of two ways. It can fall and crush us, or it can come and deliver us. It can fall on our enemies. This is the weight of God. This is the glory of God. And sometimes we minimize it to simply the songs that we sing, the clothes we wear, the orthodoxy of church, our attendance, our niceties, the little things that we like to hold dear as to the things that we think the glory of God is in. And this is truly the glory of God. He can really save us from our problems, or he can crush us. Now, as we come to this passage, we go through this cycle that you see time and time again in Judges. Simply you see apostasy, that's simply people turning away from God, rejecting him, even though they're meant to be the people of God. Then we get oppression. Some judgment comes from God, and the neighbors, the Philistines or another nation, come and attack. Then we see the people of God often turn back to God in repentance. And then God delivers them. And that's the Judges. It just goes through the cycle after one after another. And we get all of these four things in this passage. The ark is now back in Kirjath-Jearim, and it's been there for 20 years. It's safely in this house. But notice that their hearts don't come back to God at this point. God has come back to them in the ark. It's now back in Israel. But the people haven't come back to God in their heart. They're going over for 20 years. They've had some measure of peace because God has saved them from the Philistines in the previous episode. But now the Philistines, you know, we forget, things happen, things change, and the Philistines are starting to come back into the fray and push some pressure on them. So 20 years of apostasy, and then we start getting the oppression as the Philistines start growing. But enter comes Samuel. Samuel's been out of the picture for the last few chapters. We see him before as a child with Hannah and his upbringing. Much later, when we're talking about David and Saul, he's much older. This is really Samuel in his prime. This is Samuel, how he operated as judge. And then, as we see later at the end of chapter 7, he's kind of going on a circuit, and that really talks much about his faithful witness over the many years. A bit like Samson. We look at Samson and we know a lot of his exploits, but they were a very small section. Even with Samson, much of what the Bible says about him, and he judged for so many years. And all that we know about those years is that he judged Israel and possibly judged them well. And here we get an insight into adult Samuel in his prime. And this is what Samuel said to Israel. And remember, he is the judge. He is also a type of priest. He isn't a priest. He's a Nazirite, which is very much has the elements of priestliness. And he has to bring God to the people. And he's so perfect for this time because the people have rejected him. The tabernacle is gone. The Philistines have done away with that. And they need a person to bring it. The whole message of God to the people. And this is who Samuel is. And we have to really look at his words, because if Israel don't listen to their words, they have nobody. And this is what Samuel spoke to the house of Israel saying. He says, and note there are four things, because we're going to have 4 points, okay? If you, A, return to the Lord with all your heart, then, B, put away the foreign gods and the asterisks from among you. And C, prepare your hearts for the Lord. And D, serve him only, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So we're going to look at four things that Samuel highlights as the things that Israel need to do. They need to return, they need to put away, they need to prepare, and they need to serve. So the first thing. Return. If we want to have the glory of God, we must first of all return. It says in verse 5 of chapter 7, it says, and Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. So they gathered together at Mizpah, drew water and poured it out before the Lord. And they fasted that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mizpah. There was obviously a push factor for the children of Israel, pushing them towards God because the Philistines were encroaching. Very much when people, when they come to become Christians, it's often to do with a push factor. You know, life is tough. And the futility and vanity of life and the purposes of life. And as that becomes real, people are pushed towards God. And it's no different here. How many people, when they came to Jesus, it was for healing. It was because of their problems. And we know that there are so many problems that we all have. We see in our news every day. But that's the push factor. But the pull factor comes from Samuel. Samuel is the pull factor. He draws them to God. The great salvation that he has to offer. And this is what he says. First thing he says about returning to God that we learn from this is we have to first of all confess it. Simply they say, we have sinned against the Lord. Many self-help groups, many good organisations, when they want to help people and push them into the direction of reform, into a better life, into a place where they should be, the first thing is often always confession. We put it different ways today, whether that's kind of a coming out or whether it's, the moment in a room that you would say that you're an alcoholic, that is a big thing, just to hear somebody come out and simply say the words. You know, we're going to have some baptism soon, and we're going to have people who will give a testimony. And the importance of that is just simply, part of it is to hear them say their testimony, just to hear the words. We want to see the life as well, but it has to start, surely, with words, just saying, look, God, I've done wrong. I am at fault here. But it doesn't end there. We also have to draw a line under it. We also have to pull out the wrong in our lives for what it is. Notice in the passage it says that they fasted that day. And we're not going to go into the theology of fasting as such, but I want to draw just this idea out. Fasting is obviously not eating. You can not eat for medical reasons. You can fast in a process or for religious reasons. But often that fasting, you can't not notice fasting. If you want to devote yourself to God, quite often people fasted to underline their intention, to draw a line under it. You know, people often don't change their lives. We don't change ourselves until the pain of just simply not changing gets so great that we have to change. And we can often just let things run and run and run. And we often wait until we're right at the bottom of despair before we lift ourselves out. Fasting draws that line before it's too late. It's quite an important thing to think about when we're turning back to God. We confess it, we want to change, but we just simply don't make it a big enough thing in our life to really deal about. And we wait until it's really too big and it's too late. Then the other thing about returning to God, notice that they pour out water everywhere. In verse 15, this is a reading from the wrong part. But in verse 15 of chapter 1, we can look back to Hannah. She pours out her soul. In the passage inside chapter 7, it talks about the children of Israel pouring out water. Now, there is no real precedent for this in the Bible. You know, why at this point did they pour out water everywhere? It wasn't a religious thing. It wasn't something that was part of tabernacle worship. This was something different. And the only thing we can relate it back is to Hannah. And that she, in this kind of sandwich way in which it's structured, that Hannah often portrays a lot of what comes later in the book. A lot of what she says is quite prophetic of later passages. And she talks about her in her sorrowful spirit as Eli's kind of getting it all wrong and thinking that she's somehow drunk. But all she's simply doing is pouring out her spirit. You know, when we confess and we draw a line under our sin, there's no point unless it doesn't come from our heart. We have to pour out our heart. I mean, give 1,000 ritualistic, well-polished prayers that don't come from the heart and exchange it for one single prayer of Hannah's. I was just speaking in the car to Zara on the way home, and we're drawing some parallels between what Christianity is and what we believe false religion is. And we said it's the reality of it, because you can't fake it. And Christians, even Christians, try and fake it. They'll say the things in confession. You could possibly do a fast and it just be a thing. But can you fake it from the heart? That thing is something that's impossible. One thing is clear from the passage. The Philistines aren't the problem, you see. That's the immediate problem, is the Philistines. That, you would think, the first thing, right, we're going to go to God, and we're going to claim to God that they're the problem, they're the ones who are doing evil, Lord, just put judgment on them. Now that's true. But the one thing that we must always remember, when we want to point the finger at other people, the biggest problem in our life is not them. They're the biggest problem in their life, but we're the biggest problem in our life. And even at the moment when everything's hemmed in against us, we are still our biggest problem. Our problem of being far from God and not having God massive in our lives. Do you know you are the biggest problem in your life? Your sin, my sin. Confess it. Draw a line under it. Pour it out. Next thing is we have to really put it away. If we return, that is great, but then we have to put the sin away. Read this in verse 4. So the children of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths and served the Lord. This is quite basic for most Christians. It's not a matter of word only, it's deed. Okay, you can confess it, you can say all the things you like, but there has to be some actions afterwards. You've got to put it away. You've got to put away the things that you're doing wrong, the things that you're worshipping that is not God. In their case, it was Baals and Ashtoreths, physical idols. Notice this, though, about them. You think, well, why does it say Baal and Ashtoreth? They had many foreign gods at the time. At that time, you know, you can name gods and it's very fluid. When you talk about Baals, you cannot pick just one idol that they worship. There were many forms of Baal. There were many forms of Ashtoreth. That's why it often calls them Ashtoreths. There's many of them. And they had many different features depending on what region of the world they were. But in this sense, in Israel, the one thing you notice against Baal is that he is masculine. He is a male god. The Ashtoreths were a female god. And in Israel at the time, they very much had formed with the Ashtoreths a much more feminine version. It's quite typical that there would be gods of fertility, gods of war, gods of the harvest, that kind of things, all the things that make for survival in life. But many of the features of the feminine side, like fertility, had been pushed onto the feminine side. You almost got like a father and mother of religion in Israel. And it's interesting to note in the passage that when it talks about this, it talks about the children of Israel served the Baal and the Ashtoreths. They should have been children of God, but they were children of other gods. They had replaced not just the Godhead, but also their parenthood. There's that element to it. And you think, well, why is that important? The importance of parenthood is often dependency. You know, when you start talking about putting away idols, and you think, well, why is it that when I do something wrong, I can't stop myself doing it? It's often because we're dependent on it, as a child is dependent on their parents. We have to wean ourselves off it. You know, many addictions are just a case of having to wean ourselves off. We have to put them away bit by bit until they're totally and utterly gone. It's a very difficult thing to do. But yet, the process of putting away is really important. And to put away the Baal and the Ashtoreths was so important for them. It was no good them still being in their homes because it would be too much of a temptation just to go back to them. They had to deal with them. If it sins, cut it off, says Jesus. Flee temptation. Don't fight it. Too often we're in a battle of trying to fight temptation, and we should, the Bible says, flee from it. Be holy, set apart. That's completely other. Remove ourselves from the wrong. 1 Corinthians 6, flee sexual immorality. 1 Corinthians 10, 14, flee from idolatry. 2 Timothy 2:22, flee youthful lusts. Now, it's a bit of a sad thing, you know, if we're just panicking, like fleeing, incredibly scared, scattered children that don't know where to go. When we flee, where in this passage, it's not just a random fleeing away from the Baal and the Ashtoreths. It's actually a fleeing to. The fleeing to here is God. It's a place, Mizpah, and it's a flee to corporate worship. Be with other people with a like mind and put yourself in a safe place. There's no point just fleeing. I think too many Christians, even ourselves, at times we just flee sin and we end up in some kind of anemic morality in limbo land where we've fleed the world, but we haven't fled to God. We've just fled to this sort of, okay, we won't swear, we won't do this, we won't do that, we might go here, we might go there, but we haven't really fled to God. What is it in our lives that we have to put away? And where do we have to go? We have to go to God. The next thing is prepare ourselves. If we return to God, if we really do put away the things that we need to deal with, then we need to prepare ourselves. Those who have been saved by God have been reconciled to him. We've been liberated. We've been liberated to serve him. We've been liberated to show people that he is glorious, that he is weighty, he is massive. If we read from chapter 7, verse 7, it says this. Now, when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel had gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. People who turn away from God, the first thing that our enemy would ever want us to do is turn back to our old ways. This is what is represented in the Philistines. The Philistines are pushing in on Israel and they're going to force Israel back into their same slavery to idols of this world. This is the plan of the devil for many of us. When we have the liberty to glorify God, that's the thing that he wants us to not do. And we have to be prepared for that. We have to know what to do about that. The Israelites here were sitting ducks. They had gathered in Mizpah for religious celebration. The Philistines had read the situation and they'd thought it, got it completely wrong. They thought that they were gathering for an army and they felt threatened. So they came in and just wanted to wipe them out. They were sitting ducks. They didn't have a spear between them. And against the Philistine army, they would be destroyed. And even when you look back in the promises that God made to Israel, a lot of the promises will tell them that if they do not turn to God, they will be destroyed by God. It says in Deuteronomy 28:58, it says, "If you do not carefully observe all the words of the law that are written in this book, that you may fear this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God, then a number of things will happen." If you don't fear God, the glorious one, some things will happen. And it says a bit later, it says in verse 64, it says, "Then the Lord will scatter you amongst all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods which neither you nor your fathers have known, wood and stone." They're sitting ducks. If they don't turn to God, on one hand, they could be wiped out by the Philistines and exiled. That's a promise of God. That's a reality that they faced. Or if they stayed there and continued to worship God, and the Philistines came and attacked them, then they could get wiped out by the Philistines. In the wisdom of God, God brings Israel to this point of a clear decision. The great glory of the Philistines, their might and their power and their sword, or God? Are they going to stay and continue the worship of God? Will they stay and fight whatever may be? Or will they just do the natural thing and fear the Philistines more and just run for their lives, run to go and find a weapon, run to do it in their own strength? What you read in the passage is that they actually choose on the side of God. They stay. They say, "Samuel, continue worshipping, praying for us. Sacrifice the animals. Continue to make his name glorious." They continued to prepare themselves. They chose the right option. Notice that the offering that Samuel takes, it says he took a suckling lamb. I did a quick little search. I couldn't find any other reference, at least in the New King James Version, of a suckling lamb being offered. Lambs were certainly offered, but a suckling lamb, a lamb still taking its mother's milk. It's another one of those nice poetic senses in this, the passage, that this is a lamb that is highly dependent. Just a suckling lamb that they were offering to God. How weak does that seem? But the important thing about this whole passage, and this is what we must note, is that the point of weakness is the point of strength in Christianity. With God, weakness is our strength. When Jesus Christ was arrested, the false trials, the lies were made up against him. When he was mocked and beaten, they mocked him for who he was. They mocked him for being the King of the Jews. They mocked him because he said that he was God. They thought he was nothing. He was frail, he was beaten, he was put up on a cross. And they said, King of the Jews, you know, come down from the cross if you're the Son of God. And they would, we know, as humanity put him on the cross, that that's exactly who he was. But out of that whole episode, what is it that Jesus says at the cross? When it is done, he said, it is finished. The moment that God of the universe, the one full of glory, the one who has all the power to come and crush us down in destruction, or crush our enemies and deliver us, he became at the point of his weakness. He saved his people. Victory. Notice then the Ebenezer. At the end of the passage, they put up a pile of stones. It wasn't at Ebenezer. The first battle was at Ebenezer. The second battle was between two places, but they called the place Ebenezer. Because it was the point where they were weak. That was the point where the Philistines defeated Israel. And it has now become the point where he has defeated the enemy. That is Jesus Christ in a nutshell. That is why the story of Jesus Christ is beautiful. Because the whole world, the great superpower of the time, the Roman army, with the great religious function of the Jews and all of their intellect against him, crucified him. Thought they had won, and it was the great defeat. Sin and death had been done away with. Are you in the depths of suffering? Do you know what? This could well be the point of your greatest victory. If we turn to God, confess our sin, put it away, prepare our hearts, and then just finally, very quickly, serve. If we return, put away, and prepare, what next? Notice the story kind of leaves us a little bit hanging. The Lord has thundered with a loud thunder and he has defeated the Philistines. But he has defeated a blow to them. He hasn't won the battle. He has done the decisive blow, but then it was Israel that were meant to go out and finish off the job. And so they did. Jesus Christ has died and risen again. He saved us from our sins. The job is not complete. We too often leave ourselves at the cross and not just look at the cross and look through it and beyond into the future. when we look at Paul, it's similarly in the New Testament, when we look at the Acts of the Apostles, and Jesus Christ has died, risen, you think, okay, well, what next? Then you get Acts of the Apostles, and you see all the wonderful things that the apostles have done beyond the cross in terms of peacefully spreading the gospel, and we see where it's going, and there's Paul constantly saying, I'm going to get to Rome, I'm going to get to the centre of the whole world where the superpower is, and from that capital city of the world, we're going to take it to the whole world. And then you leave Acts of the Apostles a little bit like, oh, Paul's just left in prison, isn't he? What happened to that big plan, Paul? The answer is we're living it. That's the answer to the end of Acts. We're living it. We're part of the story. It's not just what's written in the Bible. We are part of that story of the plan of God. The Ebenezer, it says that the meaning of it is, thus far the Lord has helped us. Yes, the Lord has helped us thus far. This is what Jesus Christ has done. He's come to save us from our sins, from death, eternal destruction, and given us life eternal. That's how far God has helped us. But yet there is more to come, more for us to do. There's a sequel. Have you lost the glory of God? Do you want him back? Do you know what? It is possible. It is possible because in the Bible, people said that they've seen the glory of God. It says so in John chapter 1, verse 14. When it talks about Jesus, the Word, it says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. That's great news for all of us. That we can see the glory of God. The 4 points that I bring is not a DIY manual. It's not something that we do, that we step towards God and we jump through the hoops and it's by our own merit. It simply also says in John chapter 1, it says, in him was the life and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness and the darkness didn't comprehend it. The glory of God had come down to earth, Jesus Christ. It was everywhere. People could see it. Apart from people were blind, as if they were darkness themselves, they didn't have the capability. You try and explain to a blind person what colour even looks like. That is trying to comprehend God. We are incapable unless God saves us. He is a great God and has a desire for us all. Through his Spirit, he can make any one of us his. Just want to leave you on this thought. When you look at the transfiguration, if you're familiar with the story of the transfiguration of Jesus Christ in the New Testament, where he shows himself to be glorious in front of his disciples, Peter, James and John. You look at the passage, his face is sort of somehow changed and there's this sort of great spectacular light or something that is beyond like human understanding. And what are the disciples doing? The disciples are sleeping, as they always did. Technically, what a lot of us Christians do is we're often sleeping. We miss the glory of God. And when they woke up, we go into that bit of the story where they start just talking a whole load of nonsense. They start saying things that aren't quite appropriate, and that they're going to start building tabernacles and that kind of thing. But if you look closely, what did they actually miss? They missed Elijah and Moses talking. And this is why they probably got it all wrong, is because they missed what Elijah and Moses were saying. And Luke chapter 9:31 says, they spoke of Jesus' departure. They spoke of Jesus going back up into heaven. They spoke of Jesus' death and resurrection. I don't know how long they spoke for. How much they would have explained. And what he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem when he died and rose again. That is the central thing that we have to focus on everything. As Christians, if we want to understand God, we have to get back to the cross of Jesus Christ, right? Do you want God's glory? Don't miss it. Go to the cross of Jesus Christ and ask him to save us from our sins. Let's stand and sing. We're going to close. We're going to sing Before the Throne of God Above.